All right, John McWhorter, hello. Welcome to the Glenn Show, John.
Thank you, Glenn. I'm happy to be here for the first time in Blogging Heads in years from somewhere other than my office at home with the dinosaur skeleton behind me. I'm at my Columbia office, for those who are watching. Hello.
Hello. In case anyone is watching who doesn't know John McWhorter, an unlikely possibility, but in any case, there you are, Columbia University, TheRoot.com, and other affiliations, including the Glenn Show regular. You're a Glenn Show regular, and I'm so glad.
And happy to be.
So, John, we're in a political season, and you and I, you know, our conversations touch on race, politics, culture, and everything in between. And it just seems like we have to take the measure of these debates that have been going off. President Obama on October 3rd in Kentucky. They were in Kentucky, were they not? I believe so. Facing off with Mitt Romney, and the presidential race seemed to take a dramatic turn as Romney trounced the president, about which much has been written and much has been said. The president was lethargic and appeared not to be engaged, wasn't fighting for his job, etc. Poor performance, everybody acknowledges it. And then Joe Biden and Paul Ryan face off in a very spirited exchange, you might say, vice presidential, and there's a single debate. And then, just last night, as we talk here on Wednesday, October 17th, just last night, round two of the Romney-Obama drama, you know, played out. And it looks like the president may have regained some ground. He certainly gave a more creditable performance than he had the day before and all of that. So with all of these interesting, dramatic developments in the presidential campaign, I'm just wondering what my friend John McWhorter thinks about it all.
Well, I was shocked, frankly, at Obama's performance in the first debate. And I think that the good word is generally that he was thrown by Romney suddenly playing the moderate. But to tell you the truth, that doesn't ring true to me. It's not as if Romney pulled any kind of rhetorical trick that an awake person couldn't have adjusted to better than Obama did. I was surprised to see that, as much of an admirer of the man as I am and his brain, that it really is true that without the teleprompter or without text, he actually isn't as quick on his debating feet as you might expect that he would be as somebody who has been partly in his life, although he never was professionally, by primary occupation, partly a law professor. And I was just surprised. I was genuinely wondering whether it would turn out that he had been a little sick that night, that somebody had put something in his beer. It was a very disappointing performance, and I knew that he would change his ways for what happened last night. Did you have that feeling during the first one?
Well, yes, and in a conversation with Harold Pollack, another one of my Blogging Head partners, we've already covered that ground, in which I've exposed myself to the viewing audience as someone who, yes, both was shocked at the president's poor performance, was, disappointed at the president's poor performance, but I also allowed as how it's one thing to say, well, the guy does better with the teleprompter than he does, you know, responding spontaneously, like in a press conference setting or in that that podium debate setting that he was with Romney. It's one thing to say that, where the implicit judgment is that, yeah, he does better with a teleprompter, but this is really still a really strong guy. He's really got command over all the facts. He's smarter than anybody. He's a better political director than his political director. He's a better policy person than his policy person, et cetera, et cetera. And another to think, well, have I really known him? And when I saw the poor performance, do I need to update? You know, there's this guy, Nate Silver. You know what I'm talking about? The guy that writes for a New York Times blog on, like, prediction markets and
yes.
Guessing who's going to win elections and stuff like that.
And he's very good at it, yeah.
Very, very good. And he's got a book out. You could almost call it like Malcolm Gladwell-esque because it takes on, you know, a technical area of like statistical analysis, prediction, data stuff, but renders it in an idiom that's popular, accessible, that's exciting and interesting, filled with lots of examples and stuff like that. And I heard him being interviewed about his book. And he explained an idea that I didn't think could be explained to non-mathematicians, and that is Bayesian statistics, Bayes' theorem. Bottom line on it is we have beliefs, we get new data, we alter our beliefs. But we alter our beliefs not completely. You know, we weigh the new data relative to what we believed before based on the confidence of the belief that we held and the noisiness of the data that's coming in. But Bayesian analysis is about the subjective process of taking on new beliefs in the face of new observations, given that you come to the observation with already existing beliefs. Okay. So what is a Bayesian to do in the face of the president's debate performance? Do we chalk it up to, as you say, oh, he had a bad night, oh, he had something for breakfast that didn't suit him, oh, the moderator did this, oh, the guy on the other side was telling lies? Or do we update our belief about just how great a performer the president is? And in this case,
right,
estimate down our belief about that in view of the evidence. There were 90 minutes of unfettered observation of the president and his opponent on their feet, engaging in argument. And on the basis of those 90 minutes of observation, it would seem to me you would have to reestimate the president's abilities less favorably than you would have done going into the discussion.
Glenn, will it be okay for me to talk for longer than just, say, 60 seconds in response to that?
Since I talked for longer than 60 seconds and landed out, I don't see why not, John.
Okay.
You go ahead. Let me know when you're done, okay?
Okay. I think I know what you mean, and I did change my general feeling about him there. I think that President Obama is a great reciter, and there's something to that. You could get a great reputation as a great orator 100 years ago when you worked from a printed text or if you had memorized a printed text. But he is, and it's wrong to say teleprompter. That makes it sound trivial when really we could be talking about just notes or a piece of paper.
Or
he's
memory.
Very good at having something written out and reading from it. And there is a talent in that. Very many people could not do that effectively. However, I am less inclined now to think of him as himself an especially compelling person on his feet trying to make a case, because the truth is that even last night in the debate at Hofstra, he was still a much more halting and tentative speaker than Romney. Romney, actually, I'm not a fan of the man in terms of his politics, but he's a very smooth talker, and that's even off the cuff when what he's saying is sometimes is flabby in content. Still, he speaks better. And I didn't know that about Obama until these past few weeks. However, I do question, and this is another topic we can touch on.
Yes.
I really do question to what extent one's performance in these debates, either on your feet or as somebody who has been zinged once and has prepared more, which is what Obama did last night, has to do with running a nation. It all strikes me as kind of a spectator sport. I kind of enjoy it in a visceral sort of way. But no matter what Barack Obama did in this very artificial debate context, I have a hard time seeing it as reflecting significantly on what happened over the last 4 years or what would happen with another 4 years of Obama. Do you see the debates as truly significant as opposed to entertaining and maybe somewhat intriguing?
Okay, well, let me distinguish between significant in terms of the impact on electoral outcome, and on the one hand, and significant in terms of the informational content about the relevant abilities of the debaters,
yeah,
on the other, okay? I think less so on the latter front. That is, less significant as he had a poor debate. Let's say it's George Herbert Walker Bush debating against William Jefferson Clinton in 1992, just to pick an example. What am I? And George Herbert Walker Bush famously in one of those town halls looked at his watch.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and that perhaps amongst other things cost him the debate. So he quote lost the debate close quote because he looked at his watch. Okay,
mm-hmm.
So now did that tell me anything about how good a president George Herbert Walker Bush would be in a second term? Vis-a-vis the greenhorn governor from Arkansas, William Jefferson Clinton? No, of course not. Okay?
No.
Of course
yes.
not. On the other hand, did it affect the outcome of the election? Probably.
It is okay? agreed that it did, yeah.
Okay, it drove a news cycle, it fed a narrative, it disquieted some voter somewhere, so forth. So I think with respect to this first debate of President Obama with Mitt Romney, the fact that the president may be much better with the set piece recitation than he is with the spontaneous on his foot disquisition certainly has affected the dynamic of the race. I think the polls are quite clear on that. Romney has life, whereas it looked like he was going down in flames prior thereto. On the other hand, does it mean that Obama wouldn't be good in a second term, or does it make me think any less about the prospects that he would perform his job adequately going forward and deserves to be reelected? It oughtn't to, I think. I don't think the skills on display there, the skills being tested there, are so important, except for one thing, and then I'll let you get back into your long, dialogue, because I don't think you took up as much time as I did, except for one thing, and that is selling your vision and your program to the nation.
Right.
Now, I don't think the president has been very good at that. And I think that that was one of the deficits in that debate. A lack of a kind of, macroscopic 30,000-foot bumper sticker-laden, crisp sense of, this is what we're about, we progressives here early in the 21st century. This is what a second term is supposed to be. This is where I'm going to lead the nation. This is what I fervently believe in. Here, I want to inspire you. Here, I want to, so it wasn't just that he was listless, he was. But even with more energy, if he hadn't had more of a comprehensive vision, I still think that he wouldn't have succeeded. Perhaps you agree, I don't know, but it seemed quite clear to me that Romney had a vision, okay? The vision was small business drives jobs, we're going to keep taxes low so that we can, et cetera, et cetera. It was the Republican talking point vision, and he was able to sell it in an effective way, which the president wasn't able to do. So to the extent that being an effective president means being able to lay out and get the people to get behind, including even some of your initial political opponents, to get behind a compelling vision, I do think it's relevant to the job performance.
I think that Obama's in a hard place there, because I think he would disagree that he hasn't laid out his vision. It's that what he's laid out isn't very striking, because what he really wants to say is that he wants to keep doing the same thing that he's been trying to do over the past 4 years, and that maybe he'll be able to do it better if he can cut through at least some of the knee-jerk opposition that he encountered from the Republicans, and that's not exciting. And you can see this on many of the better op-ed pages, that people are waiting. David Brooks, for example, seems to be waiting for him to express some sort of new national vision that truly splits the difference between what the leaders of the Republican Party now would want and what Obama and people who agree with him would want. But the fact of the matter is, I don't think that Barack Obama wants that. I'm not sure if either you or I would be particularly interested in that particular vision, which leaves Obama in the position of feeling that his idea that America represents certainly free enterprise, but with what Republicans 10 years ago might have called compassion, that we need to bolster education, that we need to make certain efforts to keep certain kinds of jobs from going overseas, that we need to make it so that everybody has a fair shot. For him, that's the vision, and it was the vision that he had about 4 years ago, and the sorts of things that he wanted to do 4 years ago are the sorts of things that he still wants to do now, in part because he hasn't had a chance to do a lot of them because of things that are not completely of his making. And that's a problem, because we don't call that a vision. We don't seem to have any room for his vision to be, I'm trying to do something, please let me get it finished. We seem to be waiting for something that would lend itself better to a brand new kind of bumper sticker. And so that makes Romney look fresher than Obama. And I don't know, you might think that I'm just kind of trying to come up with ways of defending the man. But I think he would have said he had a vision.
Well, look. Yeah, he would have definitely said, I think it would have been something along the lines of, we're all in this together, so at some level we have a mutual responsibility, which is why the wealthy should bear their burden, and which is why efforts to protect, the disadvantaged, to provide opportunity and so forth, to give people a pathway into the middle class is something that we all should be willing to get behind. which is why the Affordable Care Act is a important achievement in terms of social legislation, because it extends the safety net in the healthcare arena to people who otherwise wouldn't have it. We're all in this together. He would say he has a vision in terms of, you know, green energy. We want to get oil and gas, but we also want to, you know, think to the longer term and worry about carbon and develop alternative energy sources and stuff like that. And as you say, I think he would, you know, jobs not going overseas, bailout of the auto industry, that the government can step in a artful way and get behind and make a difference in terms of these evolving economic pressures. We're not just subject to the whims of the global marketplace. We can be agents and shape our own, et cetera. I mean, yeah, I'm sure he would say that he had a vision. On the other hand, he definitely can't say, can he, that I'm going to do in the next 4 years just what I was doing in the last 4 years, because the counter to that is we can't afford another 4 years like the last 4 years, Mr. President. Mm-hmm. To which he says, I inherited a mess and you guys didn't help me get out of it and I'm doing the best that I can. And, you know, that probably turns out to be a pretty weak argument relative to what is actually a fresh, if in many particulars not especially attractive to me, vision that's coming from the other side. But it's definitely fresh. It's definitely something different. I mean, so.
Hey, Glenn, remind me of this. Why are we to agree that it's wrong for Obama to stress that he inherited a mess? There seems to be this idea that there seem to be two parts to the argument. One, that it's somehow viscerally unattractive, that it's whinging somehow for him to say it so much. But that, of course, is really just a matter of fashion, clothing, what our visceral sense of how we like people to sound is. And I don't find that compelling. Then the second argument is that one would expect that after a certain amount of time, he would have turned around what he was left with. But I think you, even as an economist, would know that there's no empirical basis for supposing that anybody could have created the profound kind of change that we're talking about. There's an argument that the stimulus wasn't enough, et cetera. But I'm aware of anybody who is saying that at this point we could expect there to be a difference that anybody would call dramatic or a hairpin turn from what Obama did inherit from what started happening in late 2008. And so why, I sometimes wonder, is it considered such an out-of-court thing for Obama to say, more than occasionally and more than very carefully, look at the way things were because of a very different party and a very different state of mind when I came in, and so how much can one expect me to have done in four cycles of 12 months? Is that just wrong in some summer camp way because we don't like people seeming wimpish, or it's unpleasant to listen to people complain? Because I'm not sure if I understand that argument.
Okay, I guess what I think about that is, It sounds an awful lot like excuse making and passing the buck, you know, I've been president for 4 years, all right. However, the middle class is still being crushed, as the vice president reminded us. The middle class has been crushed these last 4 years, the infamous words. You know, however, we still have not solve the problem. I've been president for 4 years. We still have not solved the problem. But you know what? I've been working hard at getting us out of this hole. And it was a terrible hole that the previous people drove us into. So he's running against this guy who's been gone for 4 years. And he's reminding the country about his failures. That is, the guy that's been gone for 4 years. But what's palpably evident to everybody is that the last 4 years haven't been a piece of cake either. So I think the reason, it's not as if as a causal argument it's wrong. You know what I mean? As if, like, if I were a historian looking back with 20 years hindsight and trying to assess just how effective a president was Barack Obama, the depth of the hole in which he found himself when he took office, two wars unpaid for, greatest economic downturn since the Great Depression, and so on, and recalcitrant political opponents with whom it was extremely difficult, like pulling teeth, to get them to cooperate on anything. It's not as if the historian would overlook those things. You know, Obama's grade will be whatever it would be. It'll be a B, it'll be a C, it'll be an A, but that would be weighted with the due consideration of the depth of the hole that he found himself in by the objective historian. But in the heat, it seems to me, you've asked me a question, I'm giving you my answer, I don't know if it's right. Mm-hmm. In the heat of a contest about one's fitness to lead the country going forward, where one is being challenged, to have your main argument be, you know, I inherited a very bad hand. When people are saying you failed, may look to many onlookers like a kind of excuse making and a lack of the assumption of responsibility, and, you know, just a convenient rhetorical trope being trotted out. We don't want to go back to the policies that got us into this mess in the first place. I mean, believe me, no one, as far as I can tell, has established that recession was caused by the economic policies of the George Bush administration. As far as I know, nobody has. Now, if you told me the reason we've got trillion-dollar deficits is because Bush took on an unpaid tax cut and he put two wars on the credit card, and then when he left office, we were in recession and we had to engage in stimulus spending with money that we didn't have in the bank, that would make makes a whole lot of sense to me. But the idea that the economic downturn, this horrible financial crisis, I mean, yeah, lax regulation, but you got Democrats to blame for that as well as Republicans. Obama hired
would be part
and Clinton, indeed, and Robert Rubin and Larry Summers. Rubin, the Treasury Secretary initially under Clinton, and then Larry Summers, who assumed the Treasury Secretaryship and who was brought back in by Obama to head his economic team, they were implicated in the relaxation of the Chinese wall between investment banking and commercial banking, the so-called Glass-Steagall Act and all of that, loosening up regulations to allow these markets to flourish. I'm sorry. Let me just try to complete my statement here. I think I think the smell of spin accompanies the observation that by the president that, yeah, things are bad, but you know what? I inherited a very bad initial hand, and moreover, the policies of the Republicans previously are the policies of the Republicans going forward. They got us in the hole, and stick with me, and we'll get out of this deep hole that in the last 4 years we haven't much gotten out of. You know, it just doesn't.
I smell rhetoric also. It's a little simplistic to say that it's the Republicans that got us into the mess of 2008 purely. But I still see, I think, more value than you do in the basic statement that the situation in 2008 was an unusually nasty economic situation for a president to inherit. And although I certainly wouldn't expect this president to say it, especially a president as inexperienced as he was, something which I certainly downplayed back then, including in conversations with you, but which I've been able to see the effect of more, I will admit, in the 4 years since. He was really, as they say in the theater sometimes, over-parted. There's more going on for him than he was really prepared for in terms of his career. But he's not going to say that. But he did inherit quite a bit that there's an argument that no president, short of some incredible stroke of luck, not skill, could have made a dramatic difference in 48 months. But I imagine that there are no quick and easy answers on that particular issue. And Obama didn't rely on it too much last night, for example, in particular. He just did his job. You know something else I noticed last night, though? And this is the sort of thing, it's kind of like the dog that doesn't bark. I think this is a very significant thing that happened. Mitt Romney prides himself on being an aggressive debater, and something he did last night that probably wasn't the best idea in that small space on television is he imposed himself physically upon Obama's space several times, and I'm sure he was coached to do this, to really put Obama in the corner, to put him on the griddle. You know, tell me, and interrupting, you know, have you looked at your pension lately?
Yeah, directing questions directly to him. You know, answer this. Didn't you say this?
Yeah, giving us that hostile profile view that we would have of Romney as he kept looking straight at the president. And you know what? Obama stood up to it, and I don't know, I haven't checked because I'm too busy this week, but I got the feeling when Romney did those things that there were some people who were inclined to interpret it as not only alpha male, but white man getting up into the face of black Obama and treating him as a child, looking down on him, little shades of Congressman Joe Wilson yelling, "You lie," during that early address that Obama made. And, you know, I think Obama held his own. He looked like a man of no particular color, taking care of himself. He could take it. Romney was obnoxious, and Obama could take it. And I'm not reading it through any kind of racial lens. I don't feel that Obama was racially belittled by being put in the face like that. And more to the point, you can see that his handlers I can just imagine the conversation. And yes, this is imagined, but I would bet some money that it was actually discussed. They said, don't be afraid to get up in his face. Don't worry that people are going to see you as attacking a black man by being too aggressive. You need to really stand your ground this time. And he decided, okay. His handlers decided it was okay. I'm glad they did. And Obama did his job. All of them were doing what I would hope we would do as we move ever more past Obama as black president. Am I reading too much into it?
I don't know. Perhaps not. I did notice the physical aggressiveness that you call attention to and the interrupting. Also with the moderator, Romney was aggressive. And I agree with you that the president stood up to it very well. I mean, for example, in this incident where Romney said, did you not come out in the speech you made in the Rose Garden after the Benghazi tragedy and not say, you know, he accused him of not having called it a terrorist attack. The president said that he did call it a terrorist attack in those remarks. Of course, I mean, Romney's broader point had some validity, which is that the administration kind of equivocated in the account that it gave of what went on and allowed for a long time public message that the public message that it had been a spontaneous uprising associated with the video. I mean, the president mentioned it often himself. So Romney was trying to make that point, but he apparently was wrong on the specific factual claim that the president's announcement the day after from the Rose Garden made no mention. Anyway, so he tries to front Obama with that and say, didn't you? And the president, instead of answering the question, tells the governor to go ahead. He says, go on, governor, you know, continue, governor. Mm-hmm. I mean, he stands his ground. He's not going to respond to the imperative that's coming from his debate opponent. Yeah. This is your time. Yeah. When my time comes, I'll speak. You don't tell me when to speak, is what I took that to mean. So he was, you know, he was alpha male to alpha male up there. I mean, and that's what he needed to do.
And Obama alpha maled him right back, and I don't think there was anything wrong with it at all. And we hear about the Republicans having been afraid in 2008 to go too racial on Obama, with the Jeremiah Wright scandal having been considered about as far as they were going to go, always with the implication that they had more material, although they didn't. Well, somewhere along the line, the Republicans this year, at least the ones connected with Romney, decided to let that go. There have been reports that they had decided to let that go. And look what happened. The world is still spinning, and, you know, we saw two alpha males, one of them white, one of them not. And I think that ultimately Obama was the victor in that one, despite Romney's aggressiveness. And I was happy to see it. Although, once again, I'm not sure that anything that went on has a whole lot to do with which one of those men would be better at running the country. Of course, if somebody is found out to be a bit of an idiot, so Rick Perry, in his oops moment and not being able to name the three departments that he would defund, or was it Gerald Ford, who didn't understand that...
There's no Soviet...
countries were.
Yeah, no Soviet domination.
Right, those are important moments, but those are rare. For Ronald Reagan to have been considered to have won anything by saying, there you go again, in that cute way. And I'm old enough to remember that. It was a good line. That had nothing to do with anything that was good or bad about how Reagan was going to run the country. I think that that aspect of debates is a little bit disturbing, because it's as if these debates are some sort of Athenian spectacle rather than a real test of how somebody would run the country. I like zingers as much as anybody else, but the fact that they can turn an election reflects unpleasantly on certain sorts of voters, as well as the punditocracy that encourages that kind of thing, if you ask me.
I'm inclined to agree with you, but it's only one of many things that reflects. I mean, the fact that political advertising changes electoral outcomes, that if I'm outspending you 3-1, you're likely to lose no matter what my merits and your merits as a candidate are, because I can out-negative message you.
Right.
And you know, the idea that the Obama camp can define Romney, or that the Romney camp can define Obama by running ads on television that creates, quote, a narrative, close quote, and that the press can either get on a bandwagon or resist the bandwagon in the service of one or another narrative defining, all these words in inverted commas, candidates this way or that, also doesn't speak very well of our democracy. You mean tell me that voters are ciphers who are going to be driven by beer commercials and political ads that are on television, and that mm-hmm. you know the weight of the dollars on the scale of public messaging is actually going to drive an electoral outcome, and it would seem to have very little or nothing at all to do either with the objective merits of the candidate, since all of these ads are distortions, misrepresentations, and you know, so on, and that their people aren't thinking for themselves, so that they say they see the ad and they say that, you know, to hell with you, that that doesn't change my belief about the person one way or the other. I can see that that's propaganda. I mean, if I see and I know that it's propaganda, I ought to discount it altogether. Propaganda should have no impact in a rational electorate, and yet it does. So, I mean, the people who are casting votes are not computers. They're mm-hmm. driven by emotion. The way that they form their judgments and their impressions is not, you know, the way that a scientist would on the basis of evidence. It's more selective, more emotive, more, you know, a kind of subconscious stuff that's going on. And artful imaging and messaging can change outcomes. And I think that, too, you know, doesn't say much good about our
democracy. It's a little
scary.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, okay, so that was debate number one. You think the Obama campaign regained some ground in the second debate, but it looks like the polls have not gone back to the way they were before the first debate. It looks like Romney made some permanent gain in his relative position, and that the election is looking pretty close at this point, even in the swing states.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I missed what you said just now at the end.
No, I was just kind of summing up. I said we've had two presidential debates. There'll be a third. The president was set back in the first and didn't completely make up the ground he lost in the second, and that the election appears to be getting tighter, and it's that mm-hmm. it's going to be quite close.
Yeah, it's not the done deal that it was almost beginning to look like, and it's a sad thing to me in a way that these little sparring spectacles can create something like that, especially because we might say as we near the end that the vice presidential debate, to me, was what a debate really could be, in that Joe Biden was doing what I call debating. You know, I was on the debate team for about 10 minutes when I was in middle school, and I remember being inculcated into what it really was to have a debate over issues and to have somebody who was really good at it standing next to you and really forcing you to make some sort of sense in an aggressive way. And it was a kind of sport, and, you know, it's the same thing I think about debating now. But Biden really made a passionate case for what the administration that he works for has been doing. I think he filleted poor Paul Ryan, as bright as Ryan is. And yet, a lot of the punditocracy, including ones who are left of center, seem to be somehow put off by the fact that Biden seemed to be enjoying it, that he has a bright smile with a lot of rather clearly bleached teeth, and that he conducted himself as a kind of lion. The idea seemed to be that he was too hot for TV in some McLuhan-esque sense. Whereas what I saw was, if we're going to have these debates and we're going to pay all this attention to them, and we who write about and think about such things have to go home and sit down and watch them instead of doing something else, at least the debate ought to be one where somebody is clearly having a good time and doing it with a real kind of relish. And you get the feeling without the studious kind of rehearsal that a Romney has to go through in order to perform in a situation like that. I loved it. And I was disappointed the next morning to find out that a lot of people, if not having sympathy for Ryan, seemed to think that Biden had somehow overdone it, when passion seems to be something that people admire so much in this country in so many other ways. What did you think?
Yeah, I was one of those people who thought that he was over the top, that he was obnoxious, that he was a bully, that he was ill-mannered. That he was playing to the base crowd and was, I think, sent out there to do precisely that, mm-hmm. you know. And I think, you know, people's reactions to this correlates highly with their, you know, prior predilections, you know. So I'm known not to be all that crazy about President Obama, even though I've said I'm going to vote for Barack Obama, not for Mitt Romney. You know, Obama's going to carry Massachusetts no matter how I vote, etc. Mm-hmm. But still, you know, I have my issues with the president and with what he represents, etc. Everybody knows about that who watches Blogging Heads. I won't rehearse that. Maybe that's why my perception of Biden's behavior was somehow less sympathetic than yours. And I would say, too, that I thought, you know, well, I thought Paul Ryan was in a difficult position. If he had punched back at all, given the differences in their ages and the kind of gravitas that Uncle Joe brings to the table.
That was a bit of an issue, yeah.
He might have looked bad punching back. You know, in some sense, smart-assed, you know, a nerdy whiz-kitty guy against a guy that's got 3 decades more experience than him, or something, nearly 3 decades more experience than him, and so on. And, you know, Biden's kind of dismissive. You know, for example, Ryan says, look, taxes have been cut and revenues have risen after the tax cut. It's happened twice. He mentioned the Kennedy-era tax cuts. Now, set aside the economics of it for a moment. Biden's response was, oh, so you're John Kennedy now. Okay.
Yeah.
The guy never said he was John Kennedy. The guy just said that in 1961 legislation was passed, and after that tax revenues went in a certain direction. He never said that he was John Kennedy. Clearly, but
strategy.
Yeah. No, it is strategy, and it was prepared. You know, clearly Biden was waiting for an opportunity to do a Lloyd Benson kind of thing on him. You know, I knew Jack Kennedy. Jack Kennedy was a friend of mine. Everybody in the audience knows
that
line.
Didn't say it.
No, of course. Yeah. Exactly. Exactly. No, it was effective. There's not any doubt about it. It was effective. It also was a cheap shot. Okay, debates are about artful cheap shots, amongst other things. I'll grant you that.
Mm-hmm.
Rhetoric is not reason. Rhetoric is
exactly.
Persuasion. It's persuasion. There's much that goes into it that's not argument as such.
Mm-hmm.
So at the level of effective debating, Joe Biden did a good job out there, and he won the debate by most accounts. At the level of, you know, did it enlist my sympathetic and enthusiastic support as I was watching it unfold? I thought the guy was obnoxious, overbearing, impolite, and a bit of an ass. You know, that's what I saw. But people have called me. People have called me the same thing, John. So.
I can honestly say that if a fire-breathing Republican had done the same performance, and I disagreed with everything or most of what that person was saying, all those shining teeth and all that, you know, yelling stuff and malarkey and all that stuff, I would have enjoyed as sport a Republican doing that to a wet behind the ears Democrat in the same way. All of which is to say that to me, these things really qualify more as sport than as substantive political debate. But I take your point. Certainly the fact that I enjoyed it as much as I did was partly because I happened to agree with most of what Biden was saying, more than anything Ryan was saying.
Well, I can tell you this. I can tell you this. If Dick Cheney in 2004 had talked down to John Edwards in that way, I can guarantee you whatever you might have thought or I might have thought, that the press would have depicted that performance in a very negative light. It would have just fed into the Darth Vader image of Dick Cheney behind the scenes doing all kind of nefarious stuff.
People
you know,
would have been selling pinatas of Cheney. Yeah, that's right.
You know,
yeah.
Whereas Biden is a hero. You know, Uncle Joe comes through for us again. You know, so
there's no doubt about that general bias, and I'm not trying to claim that I'm above it all. But yes, that's true. Cheney
okay.
could not have gotten away with it with most of the punditocracy. That's true.
We're running out of time, as you just observed. So I got to ask you this: last time we were on about a month ago, you said Obama was going to win. You were absolutely certain of it. You still that sure?
Yes, I am, partly because of the situation with the Electoral College, partly because Obama, as I expected, learned his lesson from the first debate to the extent that they're going to matter. He did well last night. I see no reason why he won't be even more prepared with the third debate. And also, my sense, and this is really just, this is a sense from looking at how elections have generally gone over the past 40 years, with the very rare exception, and even them under extraordinary conditions, there is a certain charismatic something that tends to decide these close cases. And if you look at Romney and Obama, then Obama wins that one in terms of not only just likability, but in terms of the apparent solidity of the person. You're more likely, if you're on the fence, I think at this point, given what we've seen, to tip to Obama than to Romney, despite the headlines this morning about Romney making slight inroads with women. And so, yeah, I am still telling people that the chance that Mitt Romney is going to be president of the United States in a few weeks are slim. Would you agree?
No. I think Obama has the upper hand. I don't know what the betting line is now, but it's something close to 60-40 favoring Obama. I didn't check this morning, but it's been running like that. It's narrowed from 70-30 to 60-40 since the first debate. Mm-hmm. But the dynamics in the swing states, there are people who follow this stuff for a living, so I'm just an amateur here, are moving. You mentioned the women. Are moving in Romney's direction. He's taken a lead in Florida. He's taking a slight lead in Virginia. He's narrowed the gap in Colorado. He's narrowed the gap in New Hampshire, or may have a slight lead there. He's narrowing the gap in Ohio. It looks like he's not going to get Michigan or Wisconsin close enough to think that he might win them, but Ohio might just get. So, I mean, I will be watching these next few days to see after the second debate whether or not the trend over the last 2 weeks of narrowing for Romney reverses or stops or reverses. If it does stop or reverse, I think I would still continue to think that Obama's going to win. But if this narrowing continues, the other dynamic that I think is going on is that, you know, there's the Romney of the imagining coming into these debates, and then there's the Romney of you see him perform. Now, the president did a lot better in debate number two than he did in debate number one. But Romney was strong in both debates, in my opinion. I mean, I thought his performance in debate number two was strong, and debate number one was very strong. So now, for people out there, the independents, who are saying, oh, Mitt Romney the rich guy, Mitt Romney the Mormon, Mitt Romney the guy that doesn't care about anybody, Mitt Romney the Etch-a-Sketch flip-flopper, what does he believe in, Mitt Romney the captive of the far right, Mitt Romney the rigid, inarticulate, bumbling, kind of whatever. Well, they've got now these Mitt Romneys in reality versus the Mitt Romneys of David Axelrod's imagining, and I think this latter guy is more likable. I think the likability gap is actually closed. I think the president still has a slight lead on the likability front, but it's closed. So all of these things make me less certain that the president will carry it and make me think that this next period leading up to the final debate is absolutely critical. And then there are also these things laying around like the Benghazi embassy disaster and the administration's exposure on that. There's no time for full-blown congressional hearings, but, you know, who knows what's going to come out in the next couple of weeks that might adversely affect it. So, I'm not a betting man. If I were, I'd give the president a slight nod, but those odds have narrowed sharply, and I'm not nearly as certain as you seem to be that the president's going to carry.
Yeah, I should have also added that I'm also moved by the fact that this undecided voter person generally doesn't care about what's going on in Libya that much, according to a lot of studies. The foreign policy seems more remote to that person than, almost by definition, what's going on here in this country and how it impacts them more directly. However, I take all of your points, and really I don't think that anybody can say anything with even a hint of authority about this until at least Monday, when we see more polling. But from what I see, I'm not nervous to the extent that I would be nervous about a Romney presidency today.
Yeah. Okay. Well, we are on the record, and we'll see what happens. Thanks so much for coming on the Glenn Show, John.
Well, thank you, Glenn, and I'll talk to you next time. I'm going to run teach the Quran. Have a good one.
Okay. You do that. Bye-bye.